So today I come back to gauge series, abelian and non-abelian, and I'm going to discuss in a, I hope, more quantitative way with no less formalism and less calculation. I have no time to do calculation. One of the main very important properties of gauge theory, which is the fact that they are renormalizable, like phi-4 that we have studied in length, and also that they are asymptotically free. So they behave, the effective coupling constant of the theory behaves in a very different way than it is for phi-4 or QED for that matter. So I'm going to try to discuss also at the same level QED and gauge theories, because I'm not sure you have discussed renormalization of QED in QFT1. So I'm just trying. Okay, so renormalization. Gauge series, just a first look. Okay, so let me remind you that we have studied gauge series. So we have a gauge potential A mu. Oh, and let me first discuss QED. So it's Maxwell. So QED is base of the U1 group, and A mu. So you have a gauge potential, which is just a vector, okay? And you have an action, which is just, so that the gauge potential which contains a photon, which describes the photon, with an action, which is the usual Maxwell action. So it's -1/4. Integral d4x f mu nu f nu mu. I'm mistaken. Okay. And it leads to the usual propagator for the photon. Okay. And then you have, of course, a Dirac field. So the Dirac field. Which is described by field psi alpha, where alpha has the Dirac indices. Okay, so alpha goes from 1 to 4 is Dirac indices. Mu goes from 1 to 4 because it's space-time Lorentz indices. Okay, so this is psi alpha and psi bar, of course, because it's a complex field, and the action is integral d4x, there is a high factor, and that's basically I d slash minus m, well, psi bar, I d slash minus m psi, with the indices contracted, where d slash is a covariant derivative, with d slash is a covariant, is the ordinary d slash, and plus or minus I, some factor, just have to check. I, a mu, well, I mu, plus or minus, I don't remember. Okay. So, and this describes the propagator of the photon and the interaction vertex, well, the propagator of the Dirac field, which carries some alpha beta indices, and the propagator of the Dirac field that interacts with the electromagnetic field, okay? And this contains, of course, so this is of order, oh, and let me introduce the charge. This is a charge of the electron. So it contains a factor of interaction which is proportional to the charge. And of course, you have a gamma mu alpha beta, which makes this everything covariant. Okay, so now for gauge theory, let's call SU2 for instance, or SU3, gauge theory. Now you have a mu, so you have the gauge potential is a mu a, with a goes from 1 to 3 for SU2, or from 1 to 8 for SU3, which are indices of the adjoint representation. Okay, so you have three gauge fields. The action is still of this form, but f mu nu now is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu, and if I make no mistake, minus I. And here, if I introduce a charge g, minus I g a mu a nu. Okay? So that's the gauge potential. And in addition, you have a Dirac field, which carries now alpha indices. Well, better put the indices, well, okay. Alpha indices and I indices, where alpha Lorentz and I goes from 1 to 2 for SU2, or 1 to 3 for SU3, which are indices of the fundamental representation, because they belong to the fundamental representation. So you have two different kind of charge and three different kind of charge depending on whether you deal with SU2 or SU3, okay? But nevertheless, the action is exactly the same. It's psi bar I d slash minus m psi, where d slash is the gamma mu times the covariant derivative, which still has this form for non-abelian gauge theory. Simply, you have to take into account the action. So these are the Feynman rules for QED. So for QED, the Feynman rules are you have a propagator. So you have a propagator for the bosons, you have a propagator for the Dirac field, and you have an interaction vertex. Last standard for a gauge theory. And if you want to have a gauge theory with the fermions, with fermions, gauge plus Dirac, you have this, you have this, you have a vertex of interaction which is the same, except that you have to take into account the group indices. So it involves the generator of the group. And in addition, you have the vertex interaction for the gauge field, which are of this form, and which are of this form. And again, this has a factor E, this has a factor G, this has a factor G, this has a factor G squared, okay? And in addition, we have seen that there are the ghosts. C and C bar. So this is a ghost. I should have written it here. And you have an interaction between the ghosts. Plus ghosts. You have the propagator for the ghost field, and you have an interaction between the gauge field and the ghost field with a factor G. Okay? So this is QED. This is gauge plus Dirac plus ghost. Okay? And well, in this week I've been discussing the Diracology rules, the Dirac rules, well, I'm sorry, the Feynman rules for and what kind of interaction it describes, but we have not started to discuss really the quantization, namely going beyond the classical order, semi-classical order, which involves, of course, loop diagrams. So in QED, which are the one loop diagrams for QED, there is this famous loop diagram which describes the propagator of the gauge field, which contains an internal loop of fermions. So this is describes the fact that the photon interacts, creates a virtual pair of particle and antiparticles, electron and anti-electron position, which propagates a bit, but of course it's a virtual, say, they annihilate, and but the photon interacts with a quantum fluctuation of the vacuum, which contains pairs of charged particles. Okay? So this is for the photon, and now for the propagator of the Dirac field, there is this diagram which physically describes the fact that the electron emits a virtual photon. So there is a fluctuation of the it interacts with a fluctuation of the electromagnetic field, but the virtual photon is reabsorbed and the photon continues. And finally, of course, you have a correction to the interaction of the vertex interaction between the Dirac field, the electron, and the photon, which is of this form. So the electrons emits a virtual photon before it interacts with the physical photon, and then it reabsorbs the virtual photons. And this is going to modify the effect, the interaction. So of course, this is a term of order E squared, and this is a term of order E cubed, because you have three lattices. And this is a term of order E squared. Okay. And now, if you do power counting, so you see what's the behavior at high energy of these diagrams. Remember that the propagator of the photon is therefore it behaves like 1/p², if you have a momentum p for the photon. I don't write all the Lorentz indices which takes into account the helicity of the photons. Similarly, the propagator for the Dirac field for the electron behaves like 1/p. It's a 1/p². Remember, it's 1/p² plus m. So at high energy, it behaves like 1/p. Okay. And so you see that, and the vertex do not contain any interaction term depending on the momenta. So you see that potentially the first diagrams behaves like, so there is an internal momentum k here flowing through this, and you have to integrate over k. So when you do some, you have d4k, integration over the internal momentum, and here you have a 1/k² because you have two momenta. So you see that this may diverge when you have a momentum cutoff k less than lambda, as lambda squared. And then you have a subdominant term, which could be of the form p² log lambda. It's just a dimension counting. Okay. Well, that's for the first diagram. So these are, okay. The second diagram that we wrote here behaves like, let me write it here, this one. Of course, I'm counting the behavior of just the irreducible part. It behaves like, again, you have some integral d for k. You have a 1 over k squared for the photon propagator, and a 1 over k for the internal Dirac propagator. So it may contain a log lambda. No, I'm sorry. It may contain a lambda d4 divided by k3. And since the propagator is 1 over, in fact, this propagator, if you have an internal momentum p, here you have a momentum p, you have a propagator which is 1 over p plus k plus m. In fact, you can check that you can have a k log lambda. I'm sorry, a p log lambda. This is going to be the propagator of a photon, of a fermion, so it's going to be a p slash. And here you might have a mass slash. Okay. And finally, this diagram here, where you have, of course, a momentum p, a momentum q, and here I have a momentum p plus q, is going to behave like d4k, if I have an internal momentum, it's not, yeah, k. It's going to behave like 1 over k squared for the propagator of the photon, 1 over k for this propagator of the Dirac field, and this propagator, 1 over k. So this is going to behave like log lambda. So that's a famous problem of the high energy, high frequency divergence of QED. Okay. And this means, remember that this is of order E squared. This means that in fact you expect that in the theory you are going to have ultraviolet divergence that you can subtract by introduce counter terms, you are going to have an action which is going to contain here terms of order, dangerous term of order lambda squared times A mu squared, because this is a propagator of an AA field. Here, you expect to have a log lambda times some D mu A, D nu A with some indices, because you have P squared. P squared means D mu, D mu. Yes?
In that diagram, the final one, should that be 1 upon k squared, 1 upon k, 1 upon q?
No. Because you see, here you have, of course, p minus k. You see? Here you have p minus k plus q. So at the end, you have p plus q. So here you have a propagator which is, here you have 1 over k squared, in fact, 1 over k squared for this, 1 over p minus k times 1 over p plus q minus k. And when k is large, this is subdominant. So this is the dominant part for large k is this. So that's for large k. Okay. So this gives terms like this. This is a propagator of the fermions. So you expect to have some psi bar lambda plus log lambda p slash. In fact, you can also have a log lambda p slash plus, well, sorry, d slash And in fact, you can have a factor proportional to M2 times psi. So this is a kind of divergence that you expect, that you need. And the third one is going to be a psi bar A mu psi times log lambda.
Sorry,
yes?
Could you please like explain what you're doing
here? Here I'm saying that this is a divergence of the diagram that can be subtracted by a counter term in the action, so modifying the original action, which I wrote in a very schematic way here, by introducing counter term that subtracts those divergences. So those divergences correspond to terms in the action, which are of this form. And you analyze that. So in fact, the counter term have to be of the form d4x times this. This is how you expect to modify the action. But you see that just assuming that you have this, and of course the calculation gives you some coefficients for this, this term breaks gauge invariance. It makes the, this would make the theory not gauge invariant. The photon would be massive. Okay. You see? Well, this is okay in some sense, because this is a renormalization of the mass. Of the electron. And indeed, there is a renormalization of the mass. And this term is of order, this corresponds to a propagator where this was of order E, and this is over E squared. So this is a renormalization of the charge. Oh, and finally, of course, this diagram, right, I have written this one. This one is a renormalization. And this one, here, let me use a third color, is a renormalization of the wave function of the electron, because it can be absorbed in a redefinition of psi, because you have the original term is psi bar d slash psi, and if you have to add to this psi bar d slash psi times log lambda, you can just absorb that into defining a new Dirac field, which is the original one plus something. Okay, and of course, you have to check that what you have here is still of the form f mu nu. Otherwise, you lose gauge invariance.
Sorry.
Yes?
I have a question for the second line. So is it renormalization of the mass or renormalization of the field?
Yes.
So it's both?
Yes.
So?
Yes.
We may
add in
counter terms.
What?
I'm a bit confused. It can be both.
How it can be?
Why it can be both?
It can be both because nothing forbids a renormalization of the field and the renormalization of what we define as a wave function of an electron. Mm. And this occurs already in phi to the four theory, except that in phi to the four, at one loop, we don't have this effect.
Yes.
But at two loop, there is a diagram that causes this effect.
Yes, my question is at the phi four theory.
Yes.
The field renormalization is that A is the a counterpart, and the
yeah, that's a corresponding phi to the 4 to the, remember, for phi to the 4, we say that we have to use a renormalization action, which is of the form d4x, some a factor d mu phi, plus some b factor over 2 pi squared, plus some c factor over 4 phi to the 4. This corresponds to a renormalization of the coupling constant, which is called G, and the coupling here is E. This corresponds to a renormalization of the mass, and this corresponds to a renormalization of the field.
Yes, so
because you change phi, you define phi, you define square root of A times phi equals some phi, some new field, phi, let's call it psi, well, no. Let's call it phi capital. And then you get the ordinary
field. My question is, should I add the second line to the A or to the B?
The second line, this has to be added to the A.
Oh, I see.
And this has to be added to the B.
Okay, I see.
So in fact, this is for phi 4. For QED, it turns out when you do the calculation that gauge invariance makes this term disappear, makes these terms to be of the right form, makes all the Diracology works well, and makes that the renormalized action for QED is of the following form. You can write it as if you renormalize, yeah, you can renormalize as some psi, some A psi bar d slash psi plus B psi bar m psi plus some C psi bar A psi, okay, and plus here some D F mu nu squared. Okay, and in addition. So this is just a renormalization of the field A mu. This is a renormalization of the field psi. This is a renormalization of the mass of the electron. And this is a renormalization of the charge E. And you have to do the calculation. So in order to do this calculation, theoreticians had to devise the correct rules to do perturbative expansion. And this was the achievement of Schwinger, Feynman, and Tomonaga. And to show that at one loop, you can renormalize indeed the charge and the mass of the electron. So QED is renormalized. Okay, so this was the birth of the theory of renormalization. And one important aspect, well, I'm going to discuss how the charge is renormalized, but you may have heard already that in QED, the effective charge of the electron is screened by quantum fluctuation. So the charge, there is screening of electromagnetic interactions by the fluctuations of the vacuum.
And what happens to the non-gauge invariant term?
The non-gauge invariant term disappears. The coefficient here is zero. When you compute it, so if you do just power counting, you may have one. But if you compute it, the calculation is quite easy. Because here you have a mu, so you have here you have a gamma mu nu. Well, you have a gamma alpha mu nu. Here you have an alpha. Well, you do the thing, and you find that this coefficient is zero because of gauge invariance. Okay. So gauge invariance is there, not only to make a classical action, a classical theory of Dirac fields and or first quantized theory of electrons and electromagnetic fields making sense, but also a full quantum theory making sense. Okay. So gauge invariance ensures conormalizability. For instance, it ensures the fact that you have no mass term generated for the photon, so that you have no unphysical transverse polarization states that causes problem. So I don't do any calculation, I don't do any details, but that's the idea. Okay, so now I've come back to the screening of electromagnetic interactions, so the screening of charge by the effect of the fluctuation of the vacuum. I'm going to discuss that together, what's happening for non-abelian gauge theory. So for non-abelian gauge theory, the situation is more complicated because we have many more graphs. Or maybe I should use this. Let me do that here because it's going to be in a parallel. Okay. For non-abelian gauge series, well, the coupling of the gauge field to the Dirac field is given by the same graph. So for non-abelian gauge theory, that's SU2 gauge theory, the diagrams involving the coupling of the gauge field to the Dirac field are now given by the same diagram, so nothing changed. Except some group factors. Okay, so for gauge, so typically for gauge plus fermions, it's the same. Okay, but now you have additional diagrams, as we have seen. So in addition to the diagrams where you have an internal loop. Loop of virtual fermions, you have this diagram where you have internal loop of gluon, while you have this diagram okay, and you have the diagram with an internal loop of ghosts. And remember, here, this is a 1 over, so if you have an internal loop with a k momentum, you have a 1 over k squared, you have a 1 over k squared, but the coupling involves derivatives, so the coupling involves momenta. So you may have a 1 over k squared here, a 1 over k squared here. If you have a momentum p, You have a 1 over k squared here. You have a 1 over k squared from the second gluon propagator. But you may have here a momentum k or p, either p or k. Here and here you may have a key or p coming from the vertex. So having a p squared makes a log divergence. But having a k squared makes a lambda squared divergence. You see? Well, for reason of parity, you have no p, even p, odd power of p, but you have a p squared plus p squared log lambda. So you see that the internal loop of bosons can generate a dangerous lambda squared quadratic divergence similar to the one which is potentially appearing in QED. Okay. Well, these diagrams generates also a lambda squared. It's a tadpole, so it doesn't have p squared dependence, but it generates a lambda squared. And this diagram, remember, the propagator of the ghost is also 1 over p squared. But the coupling involves also momentum. So this can also generate a lambda squared. That's a p squared log lambda, where p in all cases is the momentum carried by the gluon. Okay. Yes? Oh, it's simply because it's an integral of the form. You see, this propagator doesn't depend on p, and the coupling doesn't depend on p. It's a coupling like phi to the 4. It's a A term.
Also, for the first diagram, why don't we have the linear term?
Well, the linear term disappears by parity. Okay, no linear term. I think by parity. Okay. But you can induce it and check that it is non-zero. But it's just there, it's non-zero. And here too. Here too, I think. Okay. But anyway, you see that each of the three diagrams contains a lambda squared term, which would correspond to a mu squared term. So would break gauge invariance, would make the gauge boson massive without having a X mechanism to cure the trick, because there is no bosonic, there is no scalar field interaction. Okay. And in fact, it's the sum of those three coefficients which disappear. So when you make the calculation, you check that this term plus this term plus this term gives zero. Zero. But the contribution of the ghost is crucial. So if you had forgotten the ghost, you would have generated a mass for the gauge bosons.
Sorry? Yes? The sum of the four
because
we also have the gauge fermion.
No, but the gauge fermions gives the same propagator.
So it's already be zero.
We have seen that it is zero. It can be. What did I say? No. Here it cannot be zero. No. For the gauge fermions, you have just an 1 over p. The gauge fermions is this. So here it's a Dirac vertex. The vertex is like the one of electromagnetism. So here, No, you are right. No, these terms diverge, but it disappears by itself. Because of gauge invariance. This is lambda, but it disappears by itself. Gauge invariance is enough to make this coefficient zero, but gauge invariance is not enough to make the coefficient of this graph zero. You have to take into account the three of them. Okay. And so so the check that, for instance, in this coefficient, you don't generate a mass for the gluon require to have a good rules for perturbation theory for gauge field. And this had to wait the beginning of the 70s when this trick of Fadiev Popov quantization was devised, and then when people started to compute, and the first to compute, in fact, study seriously the renormalization of gauge theory was Gerhard Kofft in 72. Yes, with Voltmann.
So
yes.
The crucial part about the ghost fields is that they're fermionic, right?
So yes, so you have a minus sign here. That's plus, minus. I don't write the symmetry factors. Yeah. So the fact that the ghost is fermionic is also obviously crucial. Okay, so thanks to the ghost. So this gives to zero thanks to the ghost. But now, well, you have to consider the other diagram because this tells you that there is a renormalization of the field A mu. But now, so this means that there is a renormalization of the field. We just have the log here. The remaining good terms are logs. This one is this one. This counter term for d mu a nu minus d nu a mu squared in the action. But now, of course, the gauge field interacts. So you have to consider. This diagram, which is a diagram where you have interaction of three gluons at one loop, plus a diagram like that, like this one, well, and minus a diagram where you have three gluons, three gauge field, interacting with ghosts. And if you do power counting, this is 1 over p squared, this is 1 over k squared, this is 1 over k squared, this is 1 over k squared, but you may have a k here, a k here, a k here. The same here. So you can check that those diagrams may diverge like lambda plus some momenta times log lambda. So some of the momenta, here you have momentum p1, here you have momentum p2, here you have momentum p3, etc. So you may have some of the p's here, p1, 2, 3, times log lambda. Okay? And again, this is dangerous because this would generate a counter term of the form lambda a mu, a mu, a mu, which is not gauge invariant. Remember? This is going to be something like d mu a nu, d mu a nu a mu a nu. So that's a term that appears in the action of the Young-Mills action thanks to the covariant derivative. So again, there is a term that comes from each of the terms, and the coefficient here is zero. Thanks to the ghosts, again. So thanks to gauge invariant. So you get a counter term of this form here. Okay. Now, of course, you have also this diagram with four gluons. And we have seen that there are three kinds of diagrams with an internal loop of gluons, which are given like that with some symmetry factor, and you get minus four gluons interacting with loops, internal loops of ghosts. And again, this is 1/k². 1/k², this is 1/k². This is 1/k². But each vertex can carry a factor k. So these diagrams may diverge like 1/d4k, 1/k² to the power 4 times 4k. This gives a log lambda. Okay? So that's fine, it's a log. This gives a log lambda too for the same argument. Because you have 1/k². Oh no, but the problem is that you could have p's too. So you could have p's. So you could have a lambda 4 plus some lambda squared p's squared plus some log lambda. Here it's the same. You have 1/k, 1/k, 1/k², 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 but you could have so you could have lambda. Well, you could have lambda cube p plus lambda p squared p. No, I'm making something wrong. No, you could have a lambda squared. Lambda 4 pi 4 plus lambda cube p cube plus lambda p. Ah, okay, so you have lots of dangerous terms that come from this. And again, all those terms disappear thanks to the ghosts, and you end up with log lambda times a mu a. Which is a term which appears in the action. Of course, okay. But the final check which has to be done is that we have seen that in the original action, this term, which corresponds to a vertex like that, these terms which correspond to a vertex like that. Okay. Well, this term is over the G. This term is over the G squared. But the coefficient between this term and this term are not arbitrary. There is a relation which ensures gauge invariance. So one has to check that the coefficients of the logarithmic divergence here and the coefficients of the log lambda here indeed are the right, and you do the calculation, it works. So finally, final result of this calculation by Toft and other people afterwards, final result, the SU2 gauge theory, or in fact any gauge series, is renormalizable. Final result. At one loop. And basically, the action with a counter term is just something like that. It's you have a d4x, you have a coefficient a over 2 times d mu a nu minus d nu a mu squared plus the coefficient b over 2 times, well, the second coefficient was something which was involving some d mu a nu times some commutator of a mu and a nu. And the third term was the coefficient which was involving commutators, the products of commutators of mu and anu, okay, plus the ghosts. Of course, well, for the ghost it's the same. I've not discussed this term. And the relation between those three coefficients is such that this amounts to of the charge G, and of the field A mu. So like for QCD, for QED. For QED, you have a renormalization of the charge and a renormalization of the gauge field. But now the renormalization of the charge is due both to the original diagram of interaction. Well, the normalization of the charge is due, of course, both to diagrams involving the Dirac field and plus the gauge field plus the ghosts. The calculation is going to be different. I have not discussed the vertex of interaction of the gauge field with Dirac, but it's going to be with a loop of internal loop of fermions, but it's going to be the same. Okay. So I've not discussed all the diagrams, but this kind of calculation, which was first, to my knowledge, performed, well, at least with the exact result by Toft, which is, of course, much more complicated than that, is that gauge series, when they are non-abelian, are renormalizable at one loop. So now it's time to make a pause. And afterwards, I am also going to discuss in a qualitative way, with no calculation, how the running charge, the effective coupling constant, behaves in QCD. And it will discuss a bit of the physics. Okay, so let's meet in 5 minutes. Why? Oh yes, of course. I've not discussed that, but you have to also to check that the ghost propagator gets renormalized, because for the ghost, for instance, you have something like that. So remember, the ghost interacts with the Dirac with the gauge sheet. So it interacts like that. So this is a diagram which is very similar to the diagram for the Dirac field. But you have also to check that the vertex of the, so you have also, of course, diagrams like that. But in addition, you have diagrams like that. And in fact, when I said that the renormalization of the Dirac field was the same, that's not true, because for Dirac, you also have this, but you also have this. I'm sorry, I forgot those diagrams. So the renormalization, so that's a renormalization of the vertex interaction between the Dirac field and the gauge field, which induces another renormalization of the, so it induces a renormalization of the charge of the quark. But by gauge invariance, the charge, so this is a vertex which is a renormalization of the charge of the ghost. This is a renormalization of the charge of the Dirac particles, of the fermions. And you have diagrams which induce a renormalization of the charge, so for instance this one, and so on, is a normalization of the charge of the gauge field. But gauge invariance is satisfied if there is a precise relation, if those are the same. So one has to check in addition when doing the calculation that the renormalized charge of the ghost is the same as the renormalized charge of the Dirac particle and is the same as the renormalized charge of the ghost field. Otherwise, if the coupling are not consistent, you spoil gauge invariance. So there is a series of miracles which works for gauge theory, but you don't have to check all of these for an abelian gauge theory like Maxwell. Okay?
Why in the standard model the quarks are charged under all three?
Huh?
They're charged under U1, like electromagnetic charge, but then they also have to carry quantum charge, right?
Yeah, because the but this is because I'm not a high energy physicist, really. But the standard model is SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. Okay, so this is broken into U1. The charges, the SU2 charge are screened by the X mechanism. So you have an SU2 and there is an SU2 with a screened, if you want. Screened by the Higgs mechanism. Okay, but it remains an SU3 and a U1. And so the quarks are fermions. So they carry SU3 charge, yes, but they carry also U1 charge. It's the story of the physics of families, which goes beyond gauge theories, which is still partly not understood because the origin of the families is not, as far as I know.
Like the generations?
Yeah, the fact that you have the U quarks, the down quarks, the strange and the charge. And the charge. And they are in families.
Up, down, strange, charm, top, bottom.
And top and bottom. And they are gathered in families. We contain the electron, the neutrino, the muon, the tau, the nu tau, and how this is coupled to the gauge degrees of freedom, so the W plus, W minus, Z0, the photon, and the Higgs. Well, there is a model that works, but the origin of those families and of the relation with that and how they are mixed and how, whether the neutrino, why the neutrino are finally massive and how this is the physics of flavor and the physics of the standard model. And that is still a very active field of research because one has results, but there are no underlying completely, unique theory. So it goes to, if in order to understand, you can go beyond the standard model, look at ground unified theory, and then it's, well, physicists have results and are waiting for, hope to discover some new particles which explains, or other Higgs bosons, particle for dark matters, sterile neutrinos, of course supersymmetric particles. So problem, yeah. So. Okay. Okay. I think so. Well, it's question or coffee. I'm sorry. For me too. Either I get some drink or I answer your questions. That's okay. So let me start again for this last half. So the history, of course, the history of renormalization of gauge theories is a bit Well, you find them, for instance, described in the book by Peskin and Schroeder, and in other books, and also since Toft got the Nobel Prize for works with Tim Veltman about the renormalization of gauge theory and their work on the standard model. And renormalization of gauge theory for SU3 has been achieved by three physicists I'm going to quote, three US physicists. And also there are, of course, some Russian involved in that couldn't publish, as usual. It's a long story. And so let me mention there have been two, let's say, technical ingredients that have been very important in the study of the renormalization of gauge theories. One, which was used by Toft, is the use of dimensional normalization. Which is important in high energy physics. This is called, it leads to what is called the minimal subtraction scheme. It's called MS, minimal subtraction scheme. And there is a modified minimal subtraction scheme, which is a slight modification of that, which is very important because it's a technique of renormalizing, so dealing with the amplitudes, so those lambda, which makes things much less cumbersome. You don't have to look at lambda of lambda, log lambda. The idea is that you work of the theory in dimension of space-time, different from four, which is a very beautiful magic. It works very well in gauge theories because it preserves gauge invariance. Putting a sharp cutoff breaks gauge invariance. So you have to be very careful in order to check. But dimensional renormalization respects gauge invariance. And also Lorentz, because you deal with just with the usual rules of Diracology and of contracting vectors and tensors, but playing as if the dimension of space was different from four. And in that case, log lambdas are replaced by poles in 1 over d minus 4. So you still have high energy divergence. You still have ultraviolet divergence. But there are poles in this fiducial variables of the dimension. So finding counter terms in order to construct a renormalized theory means subtract the pole. And subtracting poles, you may use the rules of complex analysis of integrating over analytic function in dimension, etc. So that has been an important trick, important technical trick to study gauge theories. The second thing that I want to mention is that but it's something also which is something important, higher mathematics. It's called the BRST symmetry. A B is for Becky, Italian physicist. R is for Rouet. S is for Stora. And T is some Russian. I never am able to spell his name, Twitchin or something like that. And it was defined around 76, I think, so shortly after the proof of normalization. And it's an example of supersymmetry. Remember, you start from a gauge theory. You have just a gauge field A mu. You gauge, fix it. You get mu and you have ghosts. So you have a theory which involves in terms of new fields. So you have the mu's which carry gauge indices, and you have the ghosts. So you start from an action of Young-Mead theory which depends only of mu, which has a huge gauge symmetry, local gauge symmetry, because it is local. And you end up with a theory which is S gauge fixed, which depends on the mu, on the C and the C bar, which is of course not gauge invariance anymore. So there is no, the gauge fixing was in order to remove the degeneracy associated local gauge theory. So the question is, still, gauge fixing is not arbitrary. As we have seen, you have to fix the gauge and modify the action in order to have a remnant of the local gauge symmetry and in order to have all those constellations and numerical, you know, coincidence which makes the theory gauge invariant. Okay. So the question is there a remnant? Is there a remnant of gauge invariance? Okay. And the answer is yes. There is a global symmetry. So as we studied the first part of yesterday's lecture, so it's not a gauge symmetry, it's a rigid symmetry. Rigid, which involves the algebra, so the gauge group. So it's like a gauge transformation, but the generators of gauge symmetries are anti-commuting fields. So instead of making a gauge transformation a gauge transformation is changing mu into mu plus d mu alpha. Okay? And if you change this basically into mu plus epsilon d mu, the ghost field. So epsilon is some abstract anti-commuting generator, which obeys just the rule. And if you replace the d mu alpha by a d mu of the ghosts field, you see. But you must have a generator which is an anti-ghost in order ghost times anti-ghost equals something which is bosonic, which belongs to the. So if you formally you define that and similar rules of transformation for the ghosts, then you get a supersymmetry which mixes A's and C's and C bar. It mixes the gauge field and the ghosts. So it's an object which mathematically mixes bosons and fermions, anti-commuting fields and commuting fields. So it's called a supersymmetry. And this rigid symmetry, it's a global symmetry because epsilon do not depend on x. I should write this here. I'm using the last, so okay, so. So epsilon do not depend on x. So it's a rigid symmetry. So there can be currents and a charge associated to this symmetry. But of course, the charge will be fermionic, etc. So there are a lot of nice mathematics. So it's rigid, so there are currents and charge associated to this symmetry. And it is the existence of this rigid symmetry that ensures all those miracles. So you can prove the fact that you can prove the renormalizability of theory on a very general level just using this BRST symmetry. So that's a tool that is used now. And supersymmetry appears not only in gauge theories, it appears in string theory, it appears in conformal field theory that you are going to see, I think, in some advanced course. And it plays also a role, in fact, in condensed matter. So, for real. Yes?
Can you give the example for the condensed matter?
I just can mention that when you consider a disordered system, for example, if you look at the ground state of a system called a spin glass, so you have spins, classical spin like the Ising model, but you consider that the coupling at random. Are random instead. You take a Ising model, sum over ij of si sg times gij. So the si goes to plus or minus one. This is the energy of a configuration. There is a minus sign. But you consider that the gij also are plus or minus one, but fixed. So you take a random, you take a lattice. You assume that this is plus, plus, minus at random. So you choose couplings which are completely random. And then you put spin on them and you let them fluctuate. Then this is called a spin glass because it's a glass of spin. It's a spin that interacts with random interaction. And the physics of those systems. They are studied since 30 years, maybe more, and they are still not completely understood. The physics is not completely understood. But the fact when dealing with frozen, what's called quenched couplings, in some sense, in order to deal with that, an averaging of force, because then you are interested in the average of the typical coupling. This involves also some BRST, because in some sense you have some, when you average, you have some determinant of something. So it's something which is not as powerful as here, but it's used. So as in fact, as soon as you have a constraint on a system, for example, a gauge constraint, but also if you have some other problem, when you have a constraint on the system, you can deal with this constraint with this trick of a ghost operator and therefore some BRST. Okay, but this is for condensed matter. It's not. It's not the panacea, if you want. You know, it's one of the tools that one is sometimes used, sometimes not. You can use other two equivalent tools. While it's basic, it's a basic property of gauge symmetries. You can also study gauge symmetries without using BRST, but it's very very convenient. Okay. And so, as I mentioned, it's used for gauge. It's used for strings. It's used for conformal field theory, which is part of this. It's used, of course, in quantum gravity, because you must also fix a gauge of diffeomorphism in quantum gravity, etc. Okay. So now let me have just 15 minutes left, and I don't want to go beyond my time. So I'm just going to give the results, a very important result of a property of gauge theory, which is asymptotic freedom. So I'm not going to do any calculation, but since charge is renormalized, since the charge G is renormalized, well, in fact, in gauge theory, as in QED, the coupling, in fact, is the square of the charge. It's like the fine structure constant in QED. So this is what I'm going to call the coupling. So it's a coupling. Okay. And in gauge theory, since there is a renormalization, by the same kind of argument, you can ask that at an energy E, you have an effective coupling constant, effective coupling, alpha of V. Exactly like in for phi 4. Phi 4, the for phi 4, the zero for phi 4, we have seen that there is a coupling G. And you have an effective coupling. Coupling G of E. Okay. And well, the results of the calculation result at one loop, which was first performed by Toft, is that, well, you can define a beta function, okay, and which tells you that E d over dE of alpha of E is, you find a beta function of alpha of E. And this beta function is just given. And well, as you can expect, as for phi to the 4, the one loop result will be an alpha of V squared. There is no linear term. And it turns out that there is a coefficient here. Let's call it B. But this coefficient is negative. So B2, it's negative coefficient. And B2, well, it was computed. Where is it written? So B2 is, there's probably a 2. So minus B2, let's call it. It's minus 2 over 4 pi squared. This is the famous. And then the result is minus 111 divided by 3 times some number, let's call it C2, which depends on the group, G. And if you have fermions, this is 4/3 of NF of some other coefficient, which is called CR. So this coefficient C2 is called the Casimir the quadratic, well, it's an invariant. So so it's defined such that when you have the F A C D F, B, C, D of the structure constant of the group, when you multiply it by contracting two indices here and here, well, you get delta AB times this C2 of G. So for SU2, the C2 is 2. For SUN, this C2 is N. And this coefficient CR is a characteristic. So this is the definition of C2. And this depends on the representation of the fermions. And this is a number of families of fermions. Okay, so this is the results that you can find in, for instance, it's derived in the book by Peskin and Schroeder. Okay, so the important thing is that if NF equals zero, so if you have just pure gauge, this is negative. The beta function behaves like that. And so this means that you have a negative coefficient here. So this means that alpha of E decreases, goes to zero when E goes to infinity. No fermions. Okay? It means that the effective interaction, the effective charge of the gauge bosons goes to zero. The interaction is weak at high energy, strong at low energy. Okay. And this has very important consequences. This property is called asymptotic freedom at high energy. It means that when you have a gauge theory of gluons, so gauge bosons, when you are at high enough energy, they behave like a free gas. They behave like photons because the interaction is very small. And well, this has been very important historically because the discovery of this phenomenon for non-abelian gauge theory led to the understanding of some experiment in Stanford where electrons were sent on protons, and they were the result of the experiment was that they behaved like if they were interacting with some elementary particle inside the proton, which were called the parton, which were in fact the quarks and the gluon. And the fact that they interacted individually with the quarks and the gluon, and in addition, the measure of the effective interaction shows that the higher the energy of the electron, the smaller the effective charge, was explained by asymptotic freedom. So this led to the proposal of QCD by, Gauss, Politzer, and with this guy, he's a very famous guy, and of course I can't find his name. We will check, of course. I'm sorry. We'll check on the one hand, and Politzer proposed that a theory of strong interaction was a theory group based on the group SU3. And that it could explain that all the property of the quark models, which has been developed by Gell-Mann and many other people in the 60s. Okay, so, and they got the Nobel Prize for this reason. Okay, so asymptotic freedom is a very important property of gauge theories, non-abelian. And you can check that in this formula, here you have a minus sign, and here you have a plus sign. No, I'm sorry, yeah. Which means that, for instance, fermions contribute with a positive sign and gauge boson by negative charge. So for QED, or QED, this is zero. You have one Dirac field. So for QED, the beta function is positive. So this is for QED. This is for QCD. For QED, the beta function is positive. So this is the opposite. At high energy, the interaction, the charge of the electron is larger. And this leads to problems, which has been identified since the 60s by Landau. QED is not, in fact, a fully consistent quantum theory. It works very well. That's the most successful physical theory we have up to now. It leads to results up to 10 digits of precision, that where you can compare results of experiment and results of calculation. It works very well. But at very high energy, QED, we know it breaks down.
Sorry, what happens to the coefficient for U1, for QED?
For U1, I'm sorry. For U1, C2 is zero. But this coefficient comes from the internal loops. It comes from those diagrams. Talk, talk, talk. You see, if you have no vertex of interaction for the gauge field, this is zero. So for QED, no asymptotic freedom. For QCD, asymptotic freedom, well, unless you had a very large number of families of quarks. But fortunately for us, NF is not big enough to compensate this term. Okay, and well, let me mention that having strong interaction at low energy means that at low energies, the physics of a gauge field of QCD, for instance, is non-perturbative. It's not described by the Feynman diagrams. You have to take into account the full dynamics. And it becomes very, very complicated, and it cannot be just deduced from perturbation rules. And this explains well, without giving a proof, there is still no mathematical complete proof of this phenomenon, the phenomenon of confinement. The phenomenon that, for instance, if you have quarks, quarks are charged particles. They are the Dirac bosons, the Dirac fermions of QCD. So they carry charges. So at low energy, this is a Coulomb force, because at low energy, the interaction is weak, so they interact just like electrons. You have quarks, anti-quarks, they attract each other. And in particles like mesons, you have a quark, an anti-quark, they are bound by a Coulomb force. So they are like an hydrogen atom, or rather a positronium. You have electron, anti-electron. But in the positronium, you know, it's a Coulomb force, so they can separate and be free. For the quark, it's very different because it's experimentally shown everywhere, simply because you have mesons, or you have protons, hadrons, that you cannot separate them. People have tried, people have looked for free quarks, they never found them. So the strength of the interaction is at low energy, when the distance are large, become so large that they stay bound. And the potential, which is Coulomb at short distance, is linear at large distance. That's the prediction of some other theoretical models. So they are like springs. You have a spring, and the force between the extremity of the strings of the spring is much larger. You see? And this explains the phenomenon of confinement of quarks. So it's not a proof, because you need calculational tools, and perturbation theory is not going to give you the perturbation tools to study confinement. But qualitatively, it states that since the attraction is strong at low energy, you expect that the coupling is not at all perturbative and not given by Coulomb force. Okay, so that's one of the nice consequences of the calculation of the perturbed renormalizability of Gell series. So I'll end there. Well, I hope I will interest you to contour field theory. If you continue in the advanced course, you will learn much, much more, both in the standard for standard model and high energy physics. And if you are interested in more, you know, Planck scale physics, you in gauge theory, in ADS-CFT correspondence, in quantum gravity, you are also learn much, much more. But I would like to thank you for your attention, and I'm very happy to have you here. And good, hope you, good year and good future in research science. Thank you. Or may I take a, I'm trying to get a photo of the students, otherwise I forget them. So may I take a photo? I'm like young people. I cannot laugh without having what? No, you can stay.